Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I remember, like, my mom being really creative when making this house and, like, using a sucker as, like, a lamppost or something, and I just thought that was, like, the coolest thing ever.
Mary Figueroa is serious about making gingerbread houses, which has proven to be both fun and problematic throughout her life. We'll follow her as she competes for gingerbread house glory. Harvest Public Media takes a look back at a virus that decimated pig populations in the U.S. a couple years ago. Scientists are still trying to figure out what went on. We've got two recipes with Chef Daniel Orr using lentils and black-eyed peas. Then what happens when the food you've donated to your local food bank has passed its prime? Not your typical food waste story from Kate Griebel. Our news department is taking a break for the holiday this week, but we do have a couple stories from Harvest Public Media. That bacon or sausage you're eating for breakfast has an intriguing international backstory. More than 2 years ago, a fast-spreading virus never before seen in the U.S. hit the pork industry, killing millions of baby pigs and racking up nearly $1 billion in annual losses. Researchers are still trying to track the culprit, which appears to be an intrepid world traveler that may have been delivered right to farmers' barn doors. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports.
Spring 2013. The outbreak was moving fast. Hundreds of baby pigs were dying off, and nobody knew what it was. Iowa State University veterinary pathologist Greg Stevenson has seen plenty of infections. But genetic testing that spring was telling him the tissue damage under his microscope was not from one of the usual suspects. He and his colleagues were stumped.
Very quickly, we were talking in the hallways and saying, I've had this case, have you had that case?
It was a chaotic time. Was their test bad? Why hadn't they ever seen this? They asked the Animal Disease Lab at South Dakota State University to run their genetic tests to see if they could find any known virus. Scientists there, too, were mystified. Retired ISU professor Rodney Baker was head of the Iowa Pork Industry Center at the time.
Our pathologists and our scientists down there, those guys worked 24 hours, 7 days a week until they figured this thing out.
We're going into an area that we call our real-time amplification and detection.
One of those guys was Phil Gauger. He runs the molecular testing here at Iowa State's Diagnostic Lab. He realized if the old tests weren't working, something had to give.
And that's when we sat down and said, we need to look in, make sure our test is doing the appropriate thing, and we need to put up together a list of differentials because this could be something different.
Now, whether it was foresight or just luck, virologist Kyun Jin Yoon had noted when friends in Korea told him about a virus deadly to piglets, porcine epidemic diarrhea, or PED.
I had some good friends of mine over there so we can get some information about it. At the same time, we always concerned about the emerging of a new disease.
His team deployed a test they'd prepped for just such a time. Sure enough, PED had arrived in the U.S. It looked like a Chinese strain, but researchers weren't sure, and they didn't know how it got here. August 2013. The virus was spreading quickly, hopscotching among farms in 17 states. Then winter came. Farmers had no vaccine to quell the virus, and it thrived.
First at 6, pork prices at the grocery store are going up, and they could go even higher, all because of a deadly virus. That
April 2014, 30 states infected. The U.S. Department of Agriculture made reporting PED cases mandatory, but the requirement didn't take effect until June, more than a year after PED arrived. I asked USDA's Brian McCluskey whether earlier obligatory reporting might have made a difference.
If we'd had a very clear picture of how rapidly it was spreading by having mandatory reporting, I think we would have been able to institute a little bit more in the way of control procedures earlier. It might have prevented some of the spread.
Researchers remain stumped about how the virus was moving. But in the field, some veterinarians had identified a suspect, the pig's feed.
There were all kinds of anecdotal examples floating around the industry.
That's Northwest Iowa veterinarian Matt Anderson speaking at the Iowa Pork Congress in January 2015.
about, hey, I just got this feed delivered, and that feed feeds five different barns. And it wasn't until those pigs ate that feed out of that bin that we had PED virus.
September 2015, USDA released a report on how PED got here. Their best guess? McCluskey says PED may have hitched a ride in the woven fabric shipping totes that can move feed and all sorts of things around the world.
The USDA definitely did not say that the totes were how these viruses arrived. We're merely stating that this is a potential pathway that has plausibility and has some evidence to support it.
Vaccines are now available and potentially big business. The Iowa startup that created the first one just got snatched up by Merck Animal Health. Farmers remain on guard because PED still threatens pigs. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Later today, in the second part of our investigation into PED, meet one steadfast veterinarian turned disease investigator who's pursued a hunch about the international travel itinerary for this lethal pig virus. Gingerbread houses just look like Christmas. Hands up if you made them when you were a kid. Yeah, that's the case for Mary Figueroa, but she ended up turning it from a family tradition into a serious award-winning hobby. Now a junior at Indiana University, Mary has decided to throw her hat back in the ring after 3 years off of the competitive gingerbread house scene. As Matthew Peterson tells it, it's been an emotional roller coaster for Mary.
Mary Figueroa was feeling awesome. Her house is beautiful. Everybody is telling her so. But now, moments before the winners of the competition are announced, she's starting to see all the flaws. She can't stand still and keeps looking at the exit like she's going to make a break for it.
Well, I'm nervous, for one, because I want to win, obviously. And, I mean, I think I have a pretty good house, but there are some things I didn't love about it.
Like the chimney, for example. She couldn't get some pieces to fit quite the way she wanted them to. This is her third time entering the Conner Prairie Gingerbread House competition. She wants to think she has it in the bag.
I mean, I've been really cocky about it too, so hope that doesn't bite me in the ass.
Everybody's winners. You guys do such a great job. Okay, for individual adult for first place, we have...
But let's back up for a minute. We're in Mary's bedroom near the IU campus. It feels like we're in a different era. There are retro posters on the wall, as well as a homemade collage of movie stars from years gone by. The smell of gingerbread lingers in the air. This has been an important hobby of hers since high school, but her history with gingerbread goes back before that. She remembers her first gingerbread house that she made in elementary school.
I have like a picture of me and my mom and this like little gingerbread house that I made in second grade probably. And I remember like my mom being really creative when making this house and like using a sucker as like a lamp post or something. And I just thought that was like the coolest thing ever.
A few years later, she started volunteering at Conner Prairie Living History Museum as a child reenactor. That was the first time she was exposed to the gingerbread house competition.
So I'd kind of look around a bit and I thought it would be kind of fun to get some friends together just to enter the contest for fun.
She entered her first competition as a freshman in high school. And by her senior year, she placed second in the teen division at the National Gingerbread House Competition in 2012. But she kept quiet about it.
Everyone thought it was really bizarre and weird. I even had like a teacher who like kind of made fun of me about it, like in a joking way. But, you know, he would do that in front of this whole class. And then everybody was like, oh, this girl is weird. There was also a really weird article that was posted about me in the newspaper and then another article in our yearbook. And both of them were just really bad and made me sound just pretty insane about gingerbread houses. So I kind of stopped telling people that I made gingerbread houses in high school, and it was just like my secret hobby.
And when Mary got to college, she had to put gingerbread houses completely on hold because it was logistically impossible.
In the dorms, I didn't have a place to make them. And then my sophomore year of college, my kitchen wasn't very big, but this year I have a really nice kitchen and no excuse not to, so trying to get back into it.
Hey, Mary.
Hey.
Where are we going?
Back to Fishers, Indiana.
We're going back to Conner Prairie. The gingerbread house is in the trunk.
I've been awake like at least 48 hours, I think, now. I don't know. It's done. I don't want to let anybody down.
She dropped the house off on a Friday and waited 4 long days to hear the results. Hers is one of 30 houses in the competition this year. Mary and her family take up an entire row of folding chairs. The announcer is at the podium.
Okay, for individual adult for first place, we have Mary Figueroa.
I just won! I'm just kidding. I just won. Yeah, I'm pretty excited. I don't know. I was like pretty nervous.
She won first place in the individual adult category, her first ever win at the Conner Prairie competition. And she also won most traditional, which was unexpected.
Now I'm just excited to go see some houses. I'm going to Disney World.
She runs back into the reception hall victorious. She back in the game for good? You betcha. For Earth Eats, I'm Matthew Peterson.
This story was produced in collaboration with the Indiana University Media School. Special thanks to Sarah Neal Estes. In the second half today, cooking with lentils and black-eyed peas, then...
You know, the standards are very high in a store like Kroger. You know, any sort of cosmetic imperfection, people kind of turn their nose up at it.
The problem of food waste. From the perspective of three organizations that do their very best to not waste food... Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back. It's Earth Eats, and I'm Annie Corrigan. Part 2 of our series on the porcine epidemic diarrhea virus. You may not have heard of it, but you probably paid the price for it. The fast-moving pig virus sent the cost of bacon soaring last year. Prices have recovered, but this winter will be a crucial test in the ongoing struggle against the deadly disease. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer found a Minnesota veterinarian who is something of a germ gumshoe, tracing the infectious pathogen from China to Iowa in a journey that forever changed the meat industry.
Scott D. doesn't really look the part with his jeans and company polo shirt, but much like a detective would do, D. began taking notes as a devastating pig disease swept across the country. Porcine epidemic diarrhea, or PED, has killed millions of piglets.
I'm the director of research for Pipestone Veterinary Services in Pipestone, Minnesota.
When pigs on Pipestone Farms got sick in January 2014, he got his first big clue.
They all had this very similar history.
Each farm had received an emergency feed delivery, and all could be traced to a common feed bin.
Which, epidemiologically speaking, looked a lot to be the case, where we made a feed order, we got virus along with our delivery.
Other swine vets had made similar observations, even on farms like Pipestone's, with strict biosecurity. Dee had an idea. Treating the empty, suspect feed bin like the site of infection, he swabbed its sides with a paint roller, much like a nurse swabs your throat when you might have strep. Then he sent the rollers here to South Dakota State University's Animal Disease Lab.
So you can just step on this wet mat.
Okay. Lab supervisor Michelle Mashanti directs everyone entering the lab's animal wing to cover their street shoes with disposable booties or put on and disinfect rubber boots. This kind of biosecurity helps prevent people from inadvertently moving pathogens. Mashanti says PED can stick around in a room, even after 3 disinfecting scrub downs.
It just shows what a huge issue it is for your average pork producer. You know, we're dealing with sealed surfaces in a lab setting.
Imagine then the challenge in the far less sterile environment of a hog barn. Dee's paint roller experiment showed the virus was in the bin and, therefore, could arrive with feed. Next, Dee went searching for more specific clues. He found 9 feed ingredients that the virus could survive in.
There was this really eclectic group of ingredients which really had no commonality other than PD liked to live in them.
Actually, they had one more crucial thing in common. Many could come from China, where researchers think the U.S. PED virus originated. Public records show dozens of livestock feed ingredients are imported from China, including some the PED virus can live in. So Dee needed to know, could the virus still make hogs sick after piggybacking on feed for a ride around the world?
Across the scope room.
He decided to mimic a journey from Beijing to Des Moines. His team put samples of different ingredients into plastic baby food containers, deliberately contaminated them with the virus, and then put them into a $10,000 box called an environmental chamber. It looks like a fancy freezer with buttons and meters across the top.
I did all the programming with 3 buttons, so it took a little while.
South Dakota State lab technician Aaron Singray inputted temperature and humidity data taken from real weather records. During 37 days in the chamber, the samples experienced simulated conditions on a huge cargo ship sailing from China to San Francisco, port stops for clearing customs, and the truck trip across 1,800 interstate miles to Iowa. Then, the tainted products were fed to these piglets, who lab technicians recorded and monitored. What happened? Well, Dee expects to publish his results in a month or two. But already, he says, PED has changed the meat industry.
Feed has never been a risk factor for veterinary diseases, livestock diseases in the past. So the ability to show that feed can harbor and transmit PED in this case, I think, is a breakthrough in the changes of paradigm.
Will these results solve this transcontinental viral mystery?
The short answer is there's no clear answer.
Roger Main is director of the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab at Iowa State University.
No smoking gun, if you will.
With many unknowns lingering, farmers are on alert because the intrepid globe-trotting virus likes a cold Midwestern winter and could flare up again. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
To learn more about the international origins of pig feed and the spread of PED, visit harvestpublicmedia.org/PED.
All right. Back again. Earth Eats in the house.
Daniel Orr, making our recipe today.
Green lentils are a very economical dish, full of protein, but they get boring after a while. Everybody's had them kind of the same 5 ways. So today we're going to do them curried, kind of an Indian style.
That was the sound of onions going into a hot pot with oil?
Yes. We've got a flat-sided pan with a wider bottom than it is high. That's called a roust. And you use that pan when you want to reduce things down, cook them quickly. So we put the onions in there. We've got about 2 cups of onions. What goes better with onions and garlic? And the garlic, we're going to allow it, since it's going to be in a curry, we want it to be a little more pungent. So we're going to let that stay basically raw in there. Then I'm going to add some ginger. And ginger, when you cut ginger, you lay it down on its side and you cut through those fibers east to west instead of north to south, I guess. And then you're going to mince it. And that way you won't get big, long hairs in your ginger. I'm going to add that. We're going to add the juice of 1 orange, about a teaspoon of orange zest. Try to use organic. If you don't use organic, you need to make sure you wash your citrus really well before you zest it. Okay, and now we're going to just start building the flavors. I've got about a tablespoon of tomato paste. That's going to give us that nice acidic flavor. We're going to add our dried cherries. I think it adds a really nice dimension and get a little bit of sweet and a little bit of heat. And that, to me, is what a curry is all about. Now we're going to actually add the curry powder, about a cup of diced tomatoes, add some nice local basil. So we've got some good things going on there. I'm going to add a little bit of thyme. I'm just going to pull it right off the stems, leave the leaves whole. Some chopped parsley, cilantro, whatever you like. So we've got this nice paste made up, and now we're going to add our lentils, which are already cooked. Mix the two together. Let me give this a taste. All right, let's plate this up. Great garnished with some cilantro and some fresh citrus, and I think you'll really enjoy this great vegetarian dish.
Gluten-free for this one as well. Visit eartheats.org before you plan your next dinner. We do have time to squeeze in one more recipe. This one's for good luck in the new year, featuring black-eyed peas.
So instead of doing a traditional kind of bacon, heavy kind of black-eyed pea dish, we're going to do a very light dish that, if your New Year's resolution is to eat healthy and eat fresh, this would be a great way to start the new year. Basically, we're going to make a little dressing by mixing some olive oil and lemon juice. Okay, and then we're going to add the other components to the salad. We've got some black olives, some nice diced red pepper. I'm also going to toss in the black-eyed peas. And to give it a real crisp freshness, we're going to add some cucumbers. And I've peeled and diced these. And you have the black olives. We're also going to add some feta cheese to this. So you have some salty components. And so you want to be very careful when you season this not to add too much salt. Okay, to finish off, we're going to add a little bit of toasted walnuts. I'm going to add a nice pinch of garlic and just a handful of whatever your favorite herbs are. We use some parsley, some cilantro, and a little bit of scallion. Okay, and today I'm going to serve it just over a bed of baby arugula. Okay, and that's all there is to it. It's a wonderful way to start your new year with something light, healthy, and tasty.
Plenty more recipes where these came from at eartheats.org. The statistics on food waste in the U.S. are staggering. Upwards of 40% of our food supply is wasted, from the farm to the grocery store to our own kitchens. That equals more than 20 pounds of food per person per month. Just as staggering are the stats on food insecurity in this country, 49 million people as of 2013. These two worlds collide when we talk about rescuing past its prime food for donations to hunger organizations. But what about the waste that comes from that part of the food system? Kate Griebel wanted to learn more, so she started at a grocery store, followed its donated produce to a food bank, and then to the final destination at a soup kitchen.
You save 28, 29 a day with your Kroger.
The Kroger on College Mall Road in Bloomington, Indiana, turns over a lot of produce with the help of people like Greg Phillips.
There's a rotten tomato. These need to be gone through,
He's a produce clerk. He spends thousands of hours scanning shelves, making sure customers like what they see.
You know, we have really high standards here. We want everything to look really pretty and to be perfect. And if it's not up to that standard, then we have to pull it off the floor.
Kroger has definitive policies on what they'll sell and what they won't. Popular foods, like bananas, customers purchase tons of those. And Greg says they'll sell, even if they're a little spotted. Lots of other foods don't sell as well once they've ripened. Those are donated.
People tend to not, buy soft avocados, even if they're perfect inside. That's what we want to donate.
Then there are foods that may be wounded, dripping, or show other damage. Those present a safety risk. Those have to be thrown away.
It's a constant battle, especially something soft like tomatoes. You stock tomatoes out, and then an hour later, half of them are mush.
Greg pulls on a pair of gloves and picks up a small cluster of on-the-vine tomatoes.
These, I would discard these. They have broken skin, they're oozing, and by the time they get to a food bank someplace, they're going to be 10 times as bad, so I wouldn't donate something like that.
So, it's to the trash. Over at a stand of apples, Greg sees some tiny brown spots. These aren't bad apples, but Greg says they might never land a seat in a grocery cart.
Those will probably sell, but that would be something that I would probably donate that. You know, the standards are very high in a store like Kroger. You know, any sort of cosmetic imperfection, people kind of turn their nose up at it.
Once a food is ID'd for donation, it's sent to the back of the store and picked up by the Hoosier Hills Food Bank.
You know, we're happy to accept whatever donations we can get. We hope that people will use some common sense in doing that.
That's Julio Alonso, director of Hoosier Hills.
We are, you know, rescuing food pretty much at the very end of its lifespan. That's why it's being donated to us, because it's not something these stores can sell. You know, we work very hard to get it as quickly as possible from these locations and then get it out to agencies so that they can use it.
Alonso and his staff are more forgiving with their produce. How pretty an apple is doesn't make it more or less edible, after all. Still, Hoosier Hills has to make sure the food they send out is safe.
When we're getting bulk produce like this, there's always going to be stuff that we need to take out.
Casey Sturry has been involved with Hoosier Hills since he was a kid. He remembers that back in the 90s, they would get truckloads of potatoes.
And we have a lot of horror stories where a lot of those potatoes or a lot of that cabbage, a lot of that squash was just not very good. Nowadays, when stuff comes in, it's not in that bad of shape. The majority of the stuff that comes in, we can use.
From here, food is sent to member organizations.
Thanks, Casey.
Yeah, you guys take care.
The final safety check is the most important of all. It happens at the community kitchen of Monroe County.
Well, we're all of the staff here are knowledgeable about what's appropriate to accept as donations.
Adam Summer is the kitchen supervisor. He decides what can be made into meals and what's past the point of no return. When a big donation of produce comes in, Adam and the meal planners try to use it as soon as possible, usually within the week. It's not often that too much produce is a problem at the community kitchen. When there is a surplus, Adam and his crew work hard to make the most of it and make sure no food goes to waste.
A good example is last year we received 30 bushels of tomatoes. I mean, just way more than we thought that we could possibly use. But what we wound up doing is for some of them, we would core them, freeze them, also use them in salads. We've even done stuffed tomatoes here before, which is fantastic. That's a little labor intensive, but when you have something like that, you just have to become creative, try to figure out how to use them.
Today, the kitchen is serving chicken and collard greens. Next week, it could be completely different. It all depends on what gets donated. For Earth Eats, I'm Kate Griebel.
You can listen to this story again and look at photos at eartheats.org. Kate Griebel is an intern working with Earth Eats this year. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. See you on the flip side. I'm Annie Corrigan.